Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 74 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion or like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter, at infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. Send me a message telling me how you stay in touch with the show and include your mailing address, and I will send you a little thank you gift. If you'd like to sponsor this show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas that you have, and the challenges you get to other of your ideas. Here's the feedback of the week. From Orville on Facebook, David Crow with his show The Infectious Myth, which airs 2 p.m. Tuesday, has a well-done overview of Robert Gallo and HIV. That was the last episode, episode 73. On Facebook, we have almost 500 likes, so why don't you try to help us make it 500? And let your friends know about us and tell them to like the page, and then they can get notifications from The Infectious Myth. The most popular podcasts are my introductory show, Peter Gotchi on mammography, Tony Bark on the CDC vaccination scandal, my Ebola update, Eric Gladden on the Trace Amounts movie, Wallace Thornhill on the Electric Universe, Jim West on ultrasound, Remington Nevin on the malaria drug mefloquine, Jane Donegan and Sherry Tenpenny, both doctors, on vaccines. The most popular show is still Helen Caldicott on nuclear energy. Let me read the start of an August 2015 article in the Washington Post. Quote, "We were 14 years old when a police officer led us out of our school in handcuffs. We hadn't committed a crime, and we were dedicated students who maintained clean disciplinary records. But we could no longer abide by the shared custody agreement our parents had signed in their divorce 9 years earlier. It mandated we spend half our time with our father, a man we had no relationship with, and who largely ignored us except when he wanted something from us. When living with him became unbearable, we made the terrifying decision to use civil disobedience and refuse to go with him. A Michigan judge imposed the same injustice on three siblings last month. Judge Lisa Gorsica sentenced the, Simhoni children, ages 9, 10, and 14, to juvenile detention for refusing to meet with their father, drawing international attention. The judge dismissed the children's claims of abuse and insisted that their father was a, quote, good man. She sent them to Children's Village before relenting to public outrage and moving them to a summer camp after more than 2 weeks. I have with me today the authors of that article, the sisters Hope and Elizabeth Luden. Hope holds a bachelor's degree in international affairs from the University of Nevada, Reno. Elizabeth is a social justice activist with a bachelor's degree in environmental studies and geography from Stetson University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Yes, I'll have to have the two of you kind of organize who's speaking when, but I'm sure we'll work it out. So when?
Oh, yeah, we can work that out.
Okay. When did this actually happen, this arrest of yourselves? How long ago was that?
When we were 14 years old as freshmen in high school.
Then what happened? Did you get sent to jail? Were you charged with anything? Like what? Tell us more about what happened after you were let out in handcuffs, which must have been I can only imagine the distress of all your fellow students seeing you let out in handcuffs, like you just being caught dealing drugs or something like that.
Actually, our first attempt was unsuccessful. That Friday was supposed to be our father's time, according to the divorce decree custody agreement.
Right.
And we tried to stand up to him on that Friday and said, we're not going with you. And our mom bargained with him because she really did not want us to go to jail, you know, absolutely trying to protect us, and bargained with him to have that time. So actually, we had to do the whole thing all over again on Monday because we weren't about to go with him. We were scared, and we were sure that we couldn't keep living the way that we were. So on that Monday, you know, we ended up at that point having him, you know, out front of the school, calling the school police, calling the PD, and, you know, eventually they advertised to him that they could get us arrested for being incorrigible, which is a charge that only minors can receive, and it basically means disobedience, that you were disobedient to your parents. So we were then handcuffed and taken to a juvenile detention facility. In the back of a police car, like, you know, definitely an arrest, searched, handcuffed, and then processed through that juvenile detention facility.
And a juvenile detention facility is, to use more direct words, is basically a jail, right? For minors.
Yes, it's very interesting because we're from Reno, Nevada. Mm-hmm. And in our town, there were two separate juvenile detention facilities. And so the one that we went to is not the kind that's traditional with, you know, cells that people sit in 24/7 and, you know, have bars on them. But there were locking doors. It was a place where children were sent who had been in trouble with the law, who had gotten in trouble with drugs or, you know, whatever else that charges that for juveniles, you know, this was like their 3 or 4 week placement as part of a program.
Right. I wonder how much that improves the behavior of troubled children who have family problems to put them in a quasi jail for a few weeks and then let them back out into the same environment they came from.
Sorry, actually, it was quite destructive for them. I believe it was very sad for us because we knew that academically we would be okay when we came out. You know,
right.
We were honored students and all of that. But I did an article for Huffington Post about juvenile detention centers and how they are not for abused kids. And part of that is just how bad it is for children who are in jail, regardless of charges. They are given such a substandard education that it will probably affect the rest of their life. That is a punishment that they will probably endure, you know, for 20 or 30 years into the future.
Yeah, I feel that society doesn't really want to help these struggling families. How much easier to just let things slide until the kid goes and steals something and then slam them in jail and start the whole pipeline of spending the rest of their life in various jails. So how long were you in this juvenile detention facility before you were let out?
We were arrested after the school day ended on that Monday.
Right.
And then our mom actually was finally able to get us released by court order Wednesday evening, late at night. So it was almost the equivalent of 3 days,
right.
But definitely 2 nights that we spent in the facility. And actually, our dad's time would have been up that morning. And our
right.
mom would have been able to come and free us anyways the following morning on Thursday morning.
So if I follow the logic of this, if you'd kept resisting, they could have thrown you in a juvenile detention facility every week for half a week because you refused to go with your dad. And then at the end of that time, they'd let you out to be with your mother.
Yes, precisely. And they seemed to have the intention to do that. One of the men threatened me almost. I suppose it was certainly somewhat sadistic to hear. Upon our release, as I was packing my things, he said, "People say they're not going to come back here, but I see them again." And they were certainly planning that would be an option, I suppose, to continue putting us in jail whenever it was his time until we gave up and decided to follow what they wanted us to do, which was return to our abusive father.
Right, and was this a private facility or a government facility?
It was a government facility. They have since changed their role, as I've been told, but yes, it was a government facility.
Right, I mean, I guess even, the problem with prisons, I think one of the problems is that they're kind of self-generating, because if you have a prison that takes 1,000 people, whether it's government or, I mean, if it's private, there's an obvious financial incentive to fill it up, but even if it's government, I mean, if the prison starts to drain and you get down to 500 people, 400 people, then people start talking about closing the prison, which means you lose your job, right? So the people who work in prisons sort of kind of have an incentive to get people to come back. Repeat customers are good for business.
Oh, certainly. The privatization is an evident problem. But for us, I think that they just didn't know what to do with us, partially, because this is very uncommon for children to make that kind of decision, to decide, I will not go with this parent in favor of jail. And for us, we know how difficult that is and how terrifying it is. So it's a very strong statement for a child to say, I will not go with that person. I would rather go to jail than go with that person.
Right. And what's the age at which you would be entitled to make your own decision about having a relationship with your with a parent or not having a relationship? Is it 18 or?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because there's no written law. Most states, you know, view these kinds of cases in their own kind of family practice and custody court systems. And so some judges, you know, believe that there's an age of maturity. Some people can make an argument that there is an age of maturity, at which point, yeah, kids are considered capable in our society to make that choice. But there's absolutely no universal guidance on that. So for the vast majority of children who want to make this choice, really legally, they only have the ability to decide maybe around 17 or 18. Because at 17, you can get emancipated pretty, you know, easily as compared to ages prior to that.
Right.
And then at 18, of course, you're no longer a minor. You now have actual, you know, personhood.
Right. But, I mean, the reality is that, you know, in this kind of thing, a 12-year-old can have intelligent ideas about their relationship with their family. I mean, they're not fully mature, but they're certainly not a baby either. And it's sort of this black and white thing. A switch flips at some point, and then all of a sudden you become a person, whereas the day before you were a baby and had to be told what to do by the system.
Yes, there are studies that say that children as young as 7 actually should be given their own representation and
right.
be allowed to make those decisions. For us, it was one of the greatest frustrations. I think as children, we were acutely aware of our powerlessness, which
right.
was very difficult. We, you know, as young as, as far back as I can remember, I was very unhappy with the living arrangements that we had, and we were forced into that situation and then had no recourse. And so as children, you would like to feel like you have rights. And it's so ironic to be taught in your history classes and your government classes about the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, and then to recognize again that you do not have those decisions. You do not have those rights. They do not apply to you. And so for us, it was very frustrating. We tried to create a children's rights agency as kids, and of course, no one took us seriously because of that, but we wanted to free ourselves and free other people.
Well, it seems a little bit like being in a mental institution when you're perfectly sane, and when you argue that you're perfectly sane, that's taken as evidence that you're insane. I mean, if a child says something that sounds intelligent, they're just being precocious. You can't take it seriously.
It's fascinating, you know, the disorder that in the Simone case the children are considered to have is the parental alienation syndrome that was founded in the 80s, but it's not actually recognized psychologically. And it's interesting, one of the criteria for diagnosing a child as supposedly having parental alienation syndrome is that they have the what is called the independent thinker phenomenon, which is where they say, I didn't get told to say this. I said it myself.
So is
even
that
by saying?
Is that a disorder? That, the independent thinker disorder?
No. It's part of the diagnostic criteria for having parental alienation syndrome. So basically, the whole premise of the disorder is that children cannot be independent thinkers, and when they say and profess, "Yes, I did come up with this on my own," that's evidence that somehow they were coached into lying.
But if they said my mother told me to say it, then that would be proof that the mother was manipulating them. So they're trapped, right? No matter what they say, they're not going to be taken seriously.
Yeah, they're absolutely trapped. Unfortunately, I've heard of lots of cases. I speak to a lot of victims, and they tell me of their children writing letters, you know, talking to their teachers, and then at the end of the day, no matter what, the judge will always say, no, you couldn't possibly have written this well. You couldn't possibly have thought these things. Your mother must have done this for you. Or in some cases the father, but usually the mother is the target, and they will accuse them of brainwashing the child.
Right. So how did you break out of this cycle? Because you didn't get sent back to juvenile detention, I presume. So did the judge kind of back down at this point and give you some more flexibility, or what happened?
It's fascinating. In our case, we got very lucky. The judges had... There were a couple of judges who had considered our case. And so in the short term, what they did was provide our mother with temporary full custody, full physical custody,
mm-hmm.
so that then, you know, at least we could get out of jail, because they were not very impressed that we were sent there. And
right.
then after that, they ordered us and our mother and our father to undergo court-ordered psychological evaluation. And so, you know, they spent a small amount of time with both of our parents, but then the majority of time with Hope and I. And for maybe 4 or 5 months, a court-ordered psychological evaluator evaluated us and then in the end made a recommendation that we should be allowed to make this decision because he couldn't see how being in juvenile detention would be in our best interest. And that's kind of what the result was. But, you know, it's very possible that had we had another judge or a different personal situation in any way, our mom's reputation, our dad's reputation had been different, our reputations had been different, we may have ended up back in jail very easily.
Yeah, I can easily see that. Even a different counselor who might have said that you're just being incorrigible and the only way to get a better... relationship with your father is to spend time with him and could have easily made the recommendation that the status quo, and if you didn't like the status quo, send you back to juvenile detention until you have a better attitude.
And for us, we also stood very strong in this. We were desperate enough to know that there was no possibility that we could ever continue to be healthy if we were to go back to our father's. At the point, it was basically life or death. We were thinking, you know, there's no way that they could possibly force us to do that. And so, really, the psychological evaluator's only decision was juvenile detention or living with mom.
Right.
We're very lucky to have made the right decision.
Yeah, like, if he or she was a real hard ass, they could have said, I'm not going to take this from these two young punks, so you're going to detention until you grow up, but you are lucky, and it doesn't always work out this well. But you've gone on to continue to be involved in this. I mean, in the article in the Washington Post, you talk about the Simone case, but I presume you're familiar with quite a few different cases like this.
Yes, indeed. I've become quite involved in the activism. I blog now for Huffington Post. I also have done some journalism on the topic in other sources. The op-ed was just the start of that. Before the Simone case, which became international in terms of headlines and awareness, we were under the impression that our case was much less common than it actually is. And then upon recognizing that case was receiving attention, and that case, as I should point out, is actually still under the same judge, very little has changed aside from the imposition of a gag order. But we have since found out that the conservative estimate is that 58,000 children are placed in the custody of abusive parents every single year. And that's the conservative estimate. And so our case is obviously not very, very uncommon at all. We would hope that we were an anomaly, but then upon realizing that we were not an anomaly, we jumped in the car, we drove to Michigan, and we spoke on the Simone children's behalf. And then after that, I've continued my activism in various ways. And now radio shows, whatever I can possibly do to raise awareness is something that I'll work on.
Yeah, I think anybody could see that the Simone situation was totally ridiculous and an abuse of judicial authority. But I'm sure a lot of other cases are not quite so clear-cut and don't get any attention, and so the children just get forced to to go along with it.
You know, what's remarkable about that with the Simone case is that while it seems clear-cut, the way that the court has handled it is that it's absolutely not. It resulted, you know, after all of that national attention died down when the gag order was placed on the case, the children, you know, came back from this court-ordered summer camp and were given to their father in his custody and has been in his custody for more than 100 days now. So actually, their civil disobedience had the opposite effect. Because of the judge that's handling their case, they absolutely did not get a desired outcome. In fact, it's possibly the worst thing that could have happened in their case.
Right. So going to summer camp is often something kids look forward to, but when you're torn away from your mother and then you come back and you're sent to your father, which you don't want to do, they've stated that they don't want to be with their father because they say he's abusive. That must be a horrible situation.
I can honestly say that if this had happened to us, I mean, my heart breaks for the Simone children,
right.
And for what they've had to endure, because if this had been the result of our decision to stand up to our father and not continue going to his house and spending time in his custody, I think that I would have become even more depressed than I already was. And at that point, I think I would have felt, you know, incredibly trapped. At that, you know, the only reason we were motivated to make the decision to go to jail is that we were so trapped that we thought that this was the only thing we could do. But if we had been sent to reunification therapy, if we had been thrust back into the judicial system, into the juvenile detention system, or into our father's house, I may
right.
not be here today. I would either be in jail or most likely dead.
Right. Can you describe some other cases that you know about, whether or not you can use names or not, but talk about some other cases where there's been what might be called judicial abuse of children in a custody situation?
Yes, actually, they all kind of follow the same pattern, and you would be quite amazed at how much evidence exists oftentimes in support of the abuse claim, but is still dismissed due to judicial bias, corruption, institutional acceptance of pseudoscience such as parental alienation syndrome. And so what happens is that women will report abuse and society will tell them, if you report abuse, we'll take care of you. You should leave. You should divorce him for the safety of your children. And then when they do that, they turn around and say, but give him custody. Give him, you know, your children every couple days. And so the children are often... The mothers tell me the most horrifying things about children, you know, being pulled out from under their beds by policemen who are crying, screaming, holding onto their mother's legs, begging them, saying, Mommy, you're making me. Mommy, you know, I wish that I didn't have to go. What can you do? You're not protecting me enough. And the mother does everything in her power. And at the end of the day, the court's ruling is law. And so either the mother hands her children over to the abuser to abuse further, or the mother just has to go to jail for contempt of court. And so they're in this horrible catch-22, and they feel very hopeless and very powerless and very betrayed also by the legal system, because they have all of this evidence, and the abuser continues to abuse both them and the child because the court gives them that power, because their parental rights are considered so paramount that they are allowed to abuse their child as long as the court continues to consider that legitimate.
Right. I actually had a friend who was the mother in this situation who, I don't think the father was physically abusive, but he didn't really spend any time with the children. He had lots of money. He was busy. He just hired people to look after the children, and his interest in getting hold of the children was basically just a power struggle. He wasn't going to let his ex-wife have them, so he insisted on access and ended up getting her diagnosed with a psychological condition. And she eventually passed away, and I'm sure it's connected to the whole... It was just such a horrible situation. You know, she was put on psychological drugs basically against her will, but if she didn't go on them, then she was going to lose the children completely. And in the end, she lost her life. It was an awful situation.
I'm very sorry for your loss. That domestic violence by proxy situation is very common, and really it's the husband is usually cluster B personality, narcissism, sociopathy, and maybe not always the husband, sometimes also the wife.
Right.
You know, this affects both genders, but it's very easy for them to manipulate the system. They're very persuasive and convincing, and so they can go up and say, I want my parental rights, and then that's another avenue through which they can continue abusing their ex-wife or ex-husband.
With no real interest in the children. The children are just pawns in this game. I mean, it's kind of in a worse case, you know, when fathers kill their own children, they don't kill their children because they hate their children. They kill their children because they hate their ex. And that's the way to get back at them. And I think custody can also be like that. And as you point out, it's not just fathers against mothers. It's sometimes mothers who have these personality defects. What kind of abuse did the Shimoni children report? Is it possible to talk about that?
In the case of the Shimoni children, it's hard to say, but when you look through their transcripts from cases prior to the gag order,
right?
They had actually an ER report of some injuries that were caused to the youngest male child, Rory, during a supervised visit. And it was in the ER report listed as non-accidental trauma to the child. But that was submitted in a court case, I think, in March or April, and was dismissed by the court. But that's just one incident. There's also a lengthy description of an incident where the father was having time with the children at a park, and the children claim that he threatened their lives, and so he was trying to get them into the car, and there was a big altercation at a park as well. So the children claim that there's definitely some physical abuse that has occurred in their relationship history with their father.
And this, I presume, is quite common in the claims of children who don't want to spend time with their father or their mother, that there is physical abuse happening?
Yeah, definitely. There's physical abuse or emotional abuse. There's any number of types of abuse that could cause a child to make that decision. But generally, it's very emotionally harmful for them, and those impacts are lasting. And so the child, we now refer to the ACEs study, which is the Adverse Childhood Experiences study, which recognizes the best of those experiences, which can affect a child's health way into the future, long into adulthood. And so you actually, the higher your ACEs score, your Adverse Childhood Experiences, then the more likely you are to die prematurely of any number of common causes of death. And they're actually finding this in medical studies, and this is becoming accepted in the medical community. This is the latest research on child abuse. And so we know that this kind of trauma really does have a lasting impact on children's lives. In fact, child abuse victims are even more likely to suffer PTSD than soldiers returning from war.
Interesting. I had a question which just slipped my mind. Oh, yes. I was thinking about the power differential. Like, it's not uncommon for one parent to have a lot more financial resources than the other. This is probably usually the father because they've got a job and things like that. And in until a divorce is settled, the mother may not have much money. How much difference would it make in your case if say your mother was independently wealthy and could afford, you know, a high-priced lawyer and all that kind of stuff? Do you think it would have made a big difference?
You know, it's really interesting because I used to really think that it would have made a difference, and I used to be resentful at our mother, you know, for not doing, you know, everything she possibly could to get us out of that situation. But she was afraid, and she was abused, and she didn't know what she could do. And the only thing that
has changed my mind is learning about this Simone case. And now I'm shocked that our case went as well as it did. And I think that if she had had better legal support, more resources, et cetera, at an earlier time to approach this, you know, maybe let's say when we were 10 years old, or when we were 12 years old, the outcome could have been better, but it could have been a lot worse if we had ended up with a judge or if he had decided to invest as many resources as she invested in the court case, in the custody battle. Then it's possible that we would have ended up, you know, in reunification therapy, or he could have gotten more than a 50-50 custody split, physical custody agreement. He could have ended up with 60 or 70 or 80% or even full custody if somehow he was able to argue in court that she was an alienator and that was alienating us from him.
And so simply that accusation that a parent is alienating their children can result in them losing custody. Even if that alienation is coming from an accurate description of the other parent.
Yeah, it's actually one of the first steps to losing custody is reporting abuse. There are actually some attorneys who will tell abused women, do not report the abuse, because then you'll be accused of parental alienation syndrome. And the moment that happens, their chances of losing custody are significantly greater. And so, basically, if you don't report abuse, then you're accused of failure to protect. And if you do report abuse, then you're accused of parental alienation syndrome. It's like a gift to defense attorneys for people who are accused of domestic violence.
Right.
All they have
to
do is say, oh, I got this parental alienation syndrome. And then that's the answer.
Right. And it's, I mean, unless there's like a visit to the ER, it's pretty difficult. You know, if a parent is always screaming at the children, running them down, there's no evidence unless somebody actually happens to overhear the entire situation and will be a witness. So you might know that it's happening, but there might not be any way to prove that it's happening.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of evidence in many of these cases, and that is blatantly ignored and dismissed, and the judge will just refuse to accept it. So, for example, the case of Jennifer Collins, who was chronicled in Garland Waller's documentary, No Way Out But One. And her case was absolutely repulsive in that the judge blatantly disregarded a preponderance of evidence, an amazing amount of evidence. The son had received a concussion. There was a lot of physical abuse, and that was undeniable. And the judge looked at that evidence and said, well, even so, and gave the father custody. And so their initial consequence, I suppose, was to give full custody to the father. And then after a while, the mother was able to take the children to the Netherlands, where they became refugees. And they were the first Americans to receive asylum and refugee status in the Netherlands. And so there's a documentary about that case, and it just shows that even with evidence, a lot of these cases are still giving custody to abusers. And so that doesn't leave a lot of hope for people who don't have any evidence, which is quite a few, because emotional abuse and other types of abuse are extremely difficult to prove.
Yes. And what motivates these judges to do this? I mean, are they just, like, focused on, we need joint custody, that's the best outcome, and this one size fits all is just kind of their philosophical position, or are there other things driving them towards giving custody to somebody when there's evidence of abuse?
I'll tell you, that is probably the most loaded and bewildering question we're constantly asking ourselves. Like, why would a judge, you know, who is supposed to be interested solely in what is in the best interest of the child and the family altogether, you know, why would they make these kinds of choices? And I think that the answer to that question is multifaceted.
Mm-hmm.
There have been cases of extreme corruption. I don't think this is, you know, the reason that's the primary factor in the majority of cases, but there are cases where children have been sent to juvenile detention facilities because the judge is getting kickback.
Right. I've heard of those cases.
Some kind of corrupt exchange of money. Either the judge is being bribed to come out with a certain outcome, or, you know,
they're being bribed by a juvenile detention facility to provide more occupants. So that does happen, but I'm not thinking that that, you know, is the most commonplace answer. I think that there's also a societal preference still for the nuclear family,
right,
and an emphasis on the biological parents or parents and having a relationship with them. So the whole premise of parental alienation syndrome arguments is that the children have a right to have a relationship with both parents and need, in order to be healthy and well-functioning, to have a relationship with both parents. So that's based on maybe some religious arguments, maybe some philosophical and social arguments, but it's something that a lot of judges approach these cases as an assumption. People should have relationships with both parents. So that might be driving a lot of these court decisions.
And to be fair, there probably are cases where there are false accusations of abuse. Just, I mean, it's an easy way to get back at the other parent. And, you know, maybe judges start to say, I'm just going to ignore it because, you know, I don't know if to believe it or not, so I'll just pretend it's not happening in any cases.
Yeah, there are some accusations that are false. That certainly must exist, but it's quite uncommon. The statistics show that the overwhelming majority of abuse accusations are true. And really, there's very little incentive in most cases to claim abuse. In fact, if we could have gotten the desired outcome without having to do any of that, we certainly would have, because of the extended family. We really do love our grandparents, and we had an extended family that we really valued, and since then have not had relationships.
Right, right.
And so, you know, alleging abuse is not something that a victim takes lightly. In fact, there's usually a lot of fear involved in that. And so there's the likelihood of false abuse allegations is very small. I'm sure that it's higher than 70% that are correct and
right,
true abuse allegations.
And even
and
if there even if there are false abuse accusations, that doesn't mean that you can throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, it's work, I guess, for the judge to try to evaluate, are these true or not? But there's presumably, if there's false accusations, there's probably signs, like the accusations change over time and the timing doesn't seem to work out. And, you know, it's very difficult for people to fake a good story because, you know, when did this happen? And it turns out that, you know, you weren't there at the time or something, right? It's pretty easy to pick those things apart, but it's work for the judge as opposed to making a snap judgment from the bench. Are there cases where one parent is kind of socially powerful in a small town or something and has influence with the judges, and does that sometimes appear to be a factor?
Absolutely. I mean, I can say of some of the cases that I have heard, there are lots of women who otherwise could take their cases to media or, you know, start being more open about the abuse that they're experiencing through the court system and through, you know, like the financial abuse that they're experiencing there. And for multiple different reasons, you know, they can't because of the power dynamic. In the case of the Simone children, they're both parents actually were pretty powerful people, you know, socioeconomically, pretty high class. And so that is definitely an issue in their case, but more cases that we will never hear about involve that. In our own personal case, we were really lucky that our mother had a good reputation. I think about how if she were disabled or perhaps did have a mental illness, if she were bedridden, if she were an immigrant, if she didn't speak, you know, English fluently and, you know, whatever, there, any one of those factors could have affected things differently. And if our dad had a better reputation and was more widely known and supported,
right,
then, yeah, that also could have affected our case.
Yeah, I mean, there's a tendency.
And even so,
go ahead.
Our mother was afraid of the public ramifications as well. And his family is powerful. And so she was concerned about, you know, whether or not it would affect she was concerned about a worse outcome if she was to come out against him. And so really our situation was very difficult in that respect as well. But there are lots of very rich and very powerful and very socially respected men who happen to be abusers.
Well,
it's very difficult.
Right. I sort of had a wake-up call. I'd always seen judges as kind of isolated people that, you know, they show up on the bench and you know, they don't eat or sleep or anything. They're just kind of like I didn't really see them as people. And when my kids were in school, I realized that one of the fathers was a judge. And then I started to realize, I mean, it's just really stupid on my part, but started to realize this is just a person. And then when the few times I heard him talk, I thought, wow, this guy's got really right-wing political viewpoints, right? And he's on the bench making supposedly unbiased decisions, but his opinions are not my opinions, right? So he's going to make different decisions than I would. And he has people he socializes with, and he has people he's known from childhood. And if somebody in that circle comes, they're going to get treated differently than otherwise. Or even if it's not direct, if it's like the son of somebody he went to school with, or the son of somebody he played golf with, or something like that, it would make a big difference.
Yeah, and that's also one of the issues that people encounter in their cases with their lawyers, because the lawyer doesn't want to upset a judge that lawyer will be in front of again with other cases. And so lawyers and judges often have professional relationships that go beyond professional. And so a lot of times the judge will know the lawyer and will side with a lawyer that they like better. And so there's an issue there with people knowing each other, people being in small towns, people growing up together, and that kind of interferes with the impartiality of the judicial system.
Right. I've experienced that myself. If a judge, pardon me, if a lawyer is kind of thinking, you know, I have to go in front of this judge all the time, this is an unusual case, and if I end up pissing off the judge, it's going to impact my ability to deal with future cases, which impacts my income. Once I start to get a reputation of losing cases, nobody's going to want to come to me anymore. So I'm going to back off on this case, and that's just too bad for the people involved.
Yes, certainly that's a variable there. And I think that in the Simone case, that's been a very significant problem. It's not uncommon for the women that we talk to, the victims that we talk to go through multiple attorneys, because the attorneys will, and oftentimes they will collect fees, and then sometimes they will not sufficiently advocate for their client, especially if the case seems very difficult to win. And so because of that, finding a good lawyer can be extremely difficult and extremely expensive. It's very easy for a lot of the protective parents we encounter to go bankrupt trying to find a lawyer who will stand up to a judge that has a reputation in the community and that they will have to continue facing professionally.
And is this worse in smaller towns and rural areas where there's a smaller pool of judges and lawyers than it is in larger urban centers? Have you noticed that? Or does it also occur just as badly in say, New York City or somewhere like that?
You know, that is the question that I don't feel I'm qualified to answer, because there are so many cases, and, you know, we didn't come from a rural area. But I have heard, at least, you know, via talking to different activists and also different victims, that it sounds like it's almost epidemic in both urban and rural areas. You know, there are judges that have the best interests of children in mind and who, you know, are handling these cases to the best of their ability, and then there are many judges who are not. And so I heard about a case in San Diego. I've heard about cases all throughout urban areas as well, where
right.
This is happening. And so I think that it would be hard to generalize that there's a bigger problem in smaller court systems. I think it'll vary on a case-by-case basis, and especially the biases of those judges.
Yeah, that's a good point. If you've got a judge with a particular philosophical position or a particular bias, or that's influenced by people's status, overly influenced by people's status, then, you know, it doesn't matter if it's a farming area or a big city. Is there a place people can go to get information about these cases if they want to learn more and try to understand more about how these cases work and maybe what strategies have been used in the cases that ended better or worse?
Yes, actually, I would recommend as a starting point the LizLibrary.org, which has a wealth of information on these custody decisions and things that affect women in parental alienation syndrome. It's a very good resource. And then additionally, beyond that, there are a few nonprofits that do work on this. There's the Women's Coalition, run by Cindy DeMoss in San Diego. There's in Marin County, California, there's the Center for Judicial Excellence with Kathleen Russell. There's Child Justice Inc. with Eileen King in the D.C. area. There's Stop Abuse Campaign, which is in New York, and its board of directors includes Barry Goldstein, who's another expert. So basically, there are some nonprofits that do this kind of work, and you can look to them for information. There's also a lot of social media groups about women who are in these situations. One Mom's Battle, which is around the country, has a lot of social media presence, and so women can go to those groups, especially if they're the victims of ex-partners with narcissistic personality disorders or other cluster B personality disorders. So
right.
There's a lot of information that can be found online.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the kind of thing that's not really in your face. Like, I haven't encountered a lot of it, but I guess if you know where to look, you can find it. I'll get you to send me a list of links afterwards, and I'll post it in the show notes so that people can get better access to this information. Do you think that the mainstream media is starting to pay more attention? I mean, you had an op-ed in the Washington Post, the Huffington Post. Do you think there's more attention to this occurring?
Well, actually, I think at this time it's a little better, but unfortunately there is a historical bias against covering domestic violence in the media. It's quite a double standard. There's actually a great column by Heidi Davarin, I believe, of CNN, and I'll put that in your list that I sent
right.
you,
mm-hmm.
that explains when she was a young reporter watching police scanners and how there was an instance where a man was raping his wife in the front lawn. And she wanted to report on it, but her supervisors told her no. They said no one will care about a domestic violence issue. It's a domestic situation. And so if it's a man hitting another man or a man raping someone else, it's an issue. But if it's someone they're married to, apparently suddenly that doesn't matter in the media. And so for us, actually, with the Washington Post, it took a very long time to publish that op-ed. It almost didn't happen.
Oh, really?
And the legal team was so afraid. I'm sorry?
Well, I was just saying I'm surprised. It didn't seem like it seemed very coherent and, good summary of real cases. It didn't seem biased, or I'm surprised the Washington Post would have a hard time getting it out.
We appreciate the efforts of the editors because the editors kept working with us. But at the same time, it did take 3 weeks. We had to go through multiple drafts. The deadline was moved maybe 7 or 8 times. And the legal team continued to verify to an incredible extent. And then beyond that, all use of the word abuse was removed and replaced with mistreatment. We were not allowed to really specifically reference our own experience, which is kind of profound in its own way that, 8 years later, we still can't really talk about it as what it was, at least not in national newspapers.
Yes. And there was another comment.
I was just going to say that it was an interesting process trying to get that published. And I think that with all issues, regardless of what we're talking about in media, it could be domestic violence, it could be, talking about refugees. But there's always a wave and ebbs and flows. And so this is a fight against, court-ordered abuse and judicial abuse that's going to be for the long haul. And, there's media attention that every once in a while picks up, and you see lots of information coming out. Like when the Simone case got some attention, that's just one example. And then eventually it dies down. A couple years prior, there was Damon's Law and the case of a kid named Damon who had to get married to get out of an abusive situation. So there are many cases that have received international attention, but it comes in waves. And so we're just hoping that
we can try to keep this issue in the media as much as possible, and then maybe some high-profile cases will emerge every once in a while.
Yes, unfortunately, it's kind of like it has to keep, the abuse has to keep happening or the media will lose interest, as opposed to really digging into what's happened in the past and trying to change things so it doesn't happen. I think one thing you mentioned earlier, which is that there's, you know, the media has no problem talking about abused women, raising money for abused women's shelters, all of that kind of stuff. But then once they get to that point, and now they're trying to initiate a divorce, and they're trying to claim that there was abuse, which is why they left, and everybody in the media supports that, then there's no interest. Like, that seems to me to be the big hypocrisy in the media.
Yes, and really, we also need victims who are willing to speak out and be highlighted in the media. And a lot of times that can be very difficult because, for example, if a woman has writing skills or is a writer by career or a reporter, her husband may actually have it included in the divorce settlement that she's not allowed to write about her own experience. And so that kind of cripples people as well. And then we have one victim, Erin L. Eddy, who we're hoping will gain some high profile fairly soon. And she's a diplomat. She's a heroic diplomat. She has been recognized by Joe Biden for her work in Iraq.
Right.
And, you know, we need those people to become public figures, because we need to show that this is a multifaceted issue that does not just affect one demographic. We have everyone from people who work retail to people who are college professors to people who, you know, every single person of every ethnicity and nationality and ethnic background and education level, socioeconomic background is affected by this.
Yeah.
So we really need to show that diversity. And unfortunately, in the media, getting any attention at all is just, it's an uphill battle.
I was talking about this kind of thing to a friend yesterday. I mean, you basically have two strategies. Usually the strategy lawyers recommend when you're in some kind of a case, like you're in the middle of a divorce and a child custody hearings, is keep a low profile, don't annoy the judge by going public. But sometimes it seems like the going public is a much better strategy, because, you know, maybe the judge does get annoyed and get embarrassed, but also the judge realizes that the whole world's watching and they got to behave themselves. It's a big risk.
It would be intuitive to say that, yes, having media coverage for your particular case is going to help you. It's going to, you know, expose a judge like, for instance, Judge Gorsuch with all of the things that she said. I don't think that case got media attention because the kids went to jail necessarily as much as what she said to the children, you know, openly in the courtroom was very demeaning towards them. So in theory, yeah, that should help the Simone case. It should help the children. But in their case, their mother has since lost her job because a lot of the media attention was negative against her.
Right.
So that was a really negative consequence for her, and also the children have been given to their father, and the case has been put under gag order. So rather than it causing media to be scrutinizing Judge Gorsuch's actions, she has that ability to protect herself by issuing a gag order.
Right. So, I mean, that's an example of where going public really, so far, has backfired. I mean, maybe in the long run there'll be a better outcome. But, I mean, have they given the father, like, 100% custody, or is theoretically still joint custody in that case?
It's theoretically, I mean, on paper, joint custody, but she has no visitation. She has no contact with the kids at all. She has very little power to represent them. The judge has made it clear how she feels about the case. So really the only option now would be for her to disqualify herself because she has not considered relevant evidence.
Right.
And she has certainly shown bias in that, in proceedings. On one occasion, she even threatened the mother with a quote that said that if the show cause hearing goes forward, you will be strip searched. You will squat and be strip searched and take off your clothes. And so she's shown incredible bias against the mother, but still refuses to excuse herself from the case. And so I think that
given that reality, the mother is kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. I don't think the media attention has been entirely negative. It got us involved, and
right.
it got a lot of support from activists and people within the community. Everyone is watching this case, because a lot of protected mothers around the country would like to use this as a precedent. But unfortunately, the bias in our society is so pervasive that even a situation where Judge Corsica has been so egregiously incorrect in her misconduct, she still remains on the bench.
Yes, and there's really nobody to take her off. I mean, it's really unusual for somebody above the judge to take them off. I don't know how that could even work.
There are processes for initiating complaints and for trying to get judges examined and et cetera. That varies court by court, state by state, you know, separate counties, separate family court systems. But it's never an easy task.
And it could also backfire, too, because if it's decided not to remove the judge, then you now have an even more toxic situation. It's a lot of catch-22s
yes,
here. We've kind of come to the end of our time to discuss this. Is there anything else that you would like to say, Hope and Elizabeth, before we close?
Yes, real quickly, I just wanted to emphasize what I believe is the importance of emotional abuse as well. So we talked about proof a lot throughout this interview and about how much that works into these kinds of diagnoses and cases and decisions made by judges regarding custody. But I wanted to say that emotional abuse as well, that's something that you really can't prove. It's really almost impossible to do. But I would argue that it can be just as damaging as physical or sexual abuse, and that children's allegations should always be listened to, regardless of what kinds of abuse allegations they're making. They should be listened to. They should be investigated.
Yeah, I certainly can agree with that.
Yes, and there was actually a woman with a button at one of the rallies in D.C. recently that said that children should be seen, heard, and protected.
Yes.
And so I think we agree with that wholeheartedly there.
Seen, heard, and protected. Well, thank you very much for joining me today. And I'll let you know when the MP3 is posted, and you're welcome to circulate it. Thanks very much.
Okay, we certainly thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Infectious Myth. If you've got a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Join our community at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.